Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, we are talking about business insurance with Sean Adams of SJA Adams Insurance. Sean is a native of North Carolina, originally from Manteo, and has been in the Triangle area for 10 years. He has an education in biology, a BS degree from Campbell University, and he is an LUTCF from American College, and I'll let him tell us what that means in just a moment. He has over 12 years in the business insurance industry. He started with Farm Bureau, working for 3 years, and then in 2005, he left Farm Bureau and founded his own firm, SJ Adams Insurance. He serves there as the principal agent, and it is an independent brokerage, which we'll want him to tell us what that means also, and he has fast expertise in letting businesses understand what kind of insurance is out there, how different insurance companies work, and how to find competitive pricing for personal and commercial insurance. He is a recipient of the Founders Award with Erie Insurance in 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2014. That's impressive. And he specializes in helping individuals and small businesses with insurance needs. They offer a broad range of services for life, home, auto, bonding, commercial packages, workers' comp, and general liability, professional, and other coverages. He is a roadie at his church, and he's the treasurer of the Crabtree Rotary Club. Now, here's an interesting fact Sean gave me about himself. He appeared as a child actor on Matlock at the age of 12. He flew a plane, so that's kind of fun. So here's Sean, and we're going to be talking business insurance.
Thank you, Leah. First of all, I just kind of want to begin with what the difference between an agent and a broker is.
Okay.
Typically, an agent is somebody that is captive that works for a major firm like State Farm, Nationwide, Allstate. They only deal with one company, and they're very knowledgeable about what their company's niche is. A broker is somebody who's independent, who deals with multiple companies, and can really add an extra value to the consumer because they can look at different markets. They have access to things that are different. You see a lot more on the commercial side as far as brokers, because there's a specialty. There's certain companies that will write certain lines of business. There's some that will not.
Typically, and what do you mean, writing lines of business? Clarify.
Well, lines
that.
Of business, like workers' comp, for instance, let's say you have professional liability, you're doing mold remediation, your attorney, you need to have professional liability for your trade or accountants. Typically, the agents deal with just the home auto, maybe some small stuff, some contractors, that kind of thing, kind
right.
of limited scope. The broker can deal with a lot more, and of course, typically has more knowledge base because he can have more companies he can bring to the client and more act more as an advocate, as typically most agents are employees of the large major firms.
So a small agent, or a captive agent, let's call it that way, of a particular insurance agency offers only the products that insurance agency has, but a broker is more like going out there and assessing the free market options.
Exactly.
He's letting the competition work for the client.
They can do that. They can look at multiple companies, look at pricing, coverages. Typically, also, brokers are held to a higher standard, too, legally, if they ever were to be sued, because they're expected to know a lot more. I've worked on both sides. I started out with Farm Bureau, learned a lot about the farm industry.
Right.
And it was nice, but I don't want to transfer or trample around a bunch of farms counting sheep anymore. That was not something fun for me. I enjoy more getting out with businesses.
Well, yeah, you can step in pretty nasty stuff in the sheep fields.
So
let's talk about what kind of coverages are out there. We probably hear about general and umbrella policies the most. You've mentioned professional, workers' comp, all of those kind of things. So let's walk through some of the most common types of insurance coverages that are out there.
Okay. We'll just begin. This will be kind of a basic overview. Depending on what kind of business you're in, you may need special coverages or something that's different. Most companies are going to have what's called general liability. Now, that helps while you're on site doing installing, for instance, a contractor. You're installing something there. You also have products and complete operations, which is part of the general liability. You have an aggregate limit. Products complete operations when you leave the site. You know, something happens, let's say you're a contractor working on a roof and one of the bundles of shingles falls after you leave for lunch. It hits somebody in the head. That could be products complete operations.
Or lands on their car.
Exactly, lands on their car. A lot of small retail operations, offices also have general liability as well. One of the things they need to think about, very important, is the fire legal liability. Most plans only offer $100,000 minimum limit. This is what a lot of leases require you to have. you want to have at least $1 million, especially if you're in a large building. If you have a fire in your unit, more than likely it's probably going to damage to your neighbors. And let's say they do have a competitor's company. Well, that competitor's company can basically pay out for them what's called subrogation, go against you for the damages. Only costs a couple dollars more to increase that fire legal liability up to make sure there's your coverage. And that's one of the things a lot of business owners overlook, is to make sure what happens. Hey, I've got $1 million if somebody slips and falls in my space.
Right.
But there may be a limit on what happens if you have a fire. It could be electrical, especially restaurants are a big case. You've got a lot of grease fires. You've got a lot of transient employees that, that don't know sometimes. And, of course, you're constantly training new employees.
Well, and also in facilities where you have shared operations. I have a lot of clients that do incubators and those kind of things. And it's important for the incubators and for the companies to make sure you're aware of what risks are those coming from those other organizations around you. Because I know a couple of the sites I was at, not here locally, but outside the state, when I got there, I knew the client had chemicals, but there were no danger warning signs. There was nothing there on any building in the entire campus for the fire department, for someone coming in on the hazmat team or something to deal with it. And, you know, they have sulfuric acid, they have hydrochloric acid. There were all of these things that have special procedures. And so those kind of things, even if you have insurance and you're not doing the right things, not labeling, not warning, not communicating, can invalidate your policies, right?
It can. If you have any kind of chemicals, you're supposed to have the OSHA signs up. You're supposed to have the training. Every business needs to have the basic OSHA compliance sign. You can get a local courthouse. A lot of times your insurance agent can provide some of those for you. Also, the Fair Wage Act. If they come on site, they can give you a fine. A great example of what happened with that was during the Jimmy Dean plant that burned down in Gardner. They had some bad training of some of the subcontractor, and that actually ended up having to hit the big company.
Right.
So that's something you can always have. Make sure you have the training. And a lot of times companies will provide that for you free of charge if you just ask for it.
Or so ask your insurance company.
That's one of the things a broker can provide. You know, hey, do you have some plans or something? What are some of the ideas I can do to make sure that I'm OSHA compliant? Do you have any activities or training? That's something that's very important. Also, in the general liability, something to think about, too. Do you have items in your care custody control? Are you? Let's say you're doing a garage. You're doing mobile detailing. What happens to all those cars that gets damaged?
Well, consigned materials, if you have inventory, that's someone else's property that needs to be insured also.
Exactly. You can have that. Typically on the vehicle side is the garage keepers, which basically covers the cars only there. You may have a dry cleaners where you have to have Bailey coverage, because think about it, all your inventory is not yours.
Well, not only that, but I have photography studios where they develop their own film. The chemicals at the dry cleaner, all of those different kinds of things, each business has to sit down with their broker and go through and say, what are my risks? How do I operate? What do I need to cover? What does general cover? And then what do I need to add on, right?
Exactly. You can add on additional limits for pollution. Simply that sometimes they'll have a separate policy just for pollution coverage if you have deal with hazardous chemicals or something like that, or for mold remediation. That's another big thing people think about. Typically, those claims come 5 or 6 years after they've done the work. If they miss some of the mold, it grows inside the walls.
Right.
You don't realize it's even there until all of a sudden, you know, little Johnny's getting sick. We can't figure out why.
Again.
Right. Exactly. So that's one of the things that can also happen.
So we go from general to umbrella?
Well, an umbrella goes over top of general liability.
Okay.
Now, one of the things I'll mention that a lot of people do have is what's called commercial package.
Okay.
You put the liability, you put the building, you put the contents all together. A lot of the commercial package sometimes cheaper than having just the general liability by itself, especially if you're an office risk. It gives you a lot of extras, like employee dishonesty. You want to make sure that your contents are replacement cost value. Also, the building. If you are renting a space, the landlord may require you to insure that building, and they can require that, and you can add that back on your policy. Is there additional insured status? Is the landlord requesting that they be listed on your policy? Is there some kind of waiver or something else where they can't go against you? All of those can be added, and of course, those are additional charges typically on most commercial policies. The commercial umbrella you mentioned about is basically additional liability policy that goes over all of your risk, whether it's workers' comp, whether it's general liability, your commercial auto, all of your it could be a landlord risk. Typically, we see a lot of landlords that have multiple properties will also have an umbrella on top of there for catastrophic loss. Your risk increase the more you have. For instance, if you've got 14 rental properties, you can't always know what's going in there. Or let's say they've got the boyfriend you don't know about that's living there that just got out of jail, or you have a domestic dispute could happen. I've gone by some rental properties, done inspections, and that's another thing they require a lot of agents and brokers to do is go out and take pictures of these buildings. I know when I went through Durham, and I took a picture, and I kept right on driving. There was a little drug deal going on in the front yard. And
uh-oh, I hope they didn't see you take the picture.
The landlord called the carrier for the landlord and said, hey, we need to get off of this risk.
Right.
That's one of the things we're required to do. The landlord didn't know he was out of state. And, of course, we called him and said, hey, you need to get out of the tenant out, but that may take 30 or 45 days.
Or longer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So well, that's
one thing that comes to mind, too, that I know general liability umbrella does not cover is flood. And companies need to be aware that only insurer for flood insurance is the government, correct?
Well, right now that is the case.
Yes.
Now, with the Bigot Waters Act, they've opened that up to private competition. It was supposed to be June of this year. It's been pushed back to January of next year. We know it's coming. We don't know exactly what that's going to be yet. The Bigot Water case basically overhauled a lot of the changes, the flood program. There's some things like repetitive risk.
Mm-hmm.
So if you basically have multiple claims every year, previously you could have as many claims as you want to and they never cancel, you never raise the rate. That's changing. Also, the grandfathering is going away. So let's say you have a small business at the coast and you have one of those policies that you've had for 15, 20 years. You may be paying $500, where your neighbor next door who opened up a business, let's say last year, may be paying $10,000 or $12,000.
Right.
They're going to be increasing at 25% every year until you get up to that limit. Now, granted, if you have one of those policies, you want to hold on to them as long as you can.
Right.
Because if you increase by 25% each year, it's going to take a long time to get up that $12,000 limit. Typical policy for FEMA is you can get $500,000 for the building and $500,000 for contents. A lot of people don't realize the contents with FEMA is actual cash value. That's like your car.
Depreciation.
As it gets older, it gets depreciated. Exactly.
So if you have 10-year-old computers, if you have 3-year-old computers and they're fully depreciated, that's zero value for the government.
Exactly. So you can have that. Now, what you can also do is you can buy excess amounts on the private market through somebody like Lloyd's of London or one of the other big flood riding carriers that'll do that on top of it. So you have a large condo association or something else, but you're required right now to go first through the federal government. They set the rate. Doesn't matter which servicing company. It could be State Farm. It could be Hartford. It could be any one of these different servicing companies. They set the rate. So you can't really shop the flood insurance. Now, we're hoping that will change with opening of the flood markets in January. Now, that may, of course, be moved back again to June. We never know with some of these government programs.
Well, and that leads me into a question I really want to cover given the time of year we're at and we're talking about flood coverage and repetitive costs. We have natural disasters. We have fires. We have floods. We have tornadoes. We have hurricanes. Different parts of the country have different issues of natural disasters and man-made disasters. What I find with most of the clients when we get in there, one of the things I rarely see them have is business interruption insurance. And we were talking before the show that like the issue we had in Apex where businesses had to be evacuated out and closed for a while. Cary had a water issue there for a while. The restaurants couldn't be open, et cetera. Your business is closed down due to a snow, a natural disaster. It's wiped out. It's great to have flood insurance to replace some of it. But what do we cover ourselves with to get the income coming in, the replacement costs, that kind of stuff, while we are trying to get back in business?
That's a great question. The flood policy does not cover business interruption coverage.
Right.
That's a lot of people don't think about. Have a flood, okay, the contents, you're going to get your building. You've also got to fill out a proof of loss, and usually takes about 30 to 60 days before you get any money from FEMA.
You're lucky, it's been as much as 6 months. Look at Hurricane Sandy, how long it has taken for so many of those people to get.
Exactly. Typically, there are government contractors that fill it out, and it's done by stages. I know with my parents, when they had Hurricane Irene came through and hit their house, I dealt with 4 different contractors, and I had to kind of quarterback it basically on different parts of the whole process. The proof of loss form was 16 pages long.
Well, I had to deal with this for my mother and my brother when their homes were flooded out. Call the line, report it to FEMA. The first question is, after you've told them there's 4 to 5 feet of water in the house, did it affect the carpet? And I'm like, no, it was on the ceiling. I mean, at that point, you're wading mud. You have nothing left. You know, your family's in a trauma. A business, same way. Some of the questions and some of the processes just don't make sense. It's the government. What can we say?
It's the government, and you got to fill the form out correctly.
And they don't have to tell you it's wrong. You have to call.
It's like the IRS. They don't tell you it's wrong until they tell you that you don't get your money.
Well, and a lot of the records you need are gone in the flood.
It could be. One of the things we actually offer a lot of our clients is we have an app on our website where they can go through with their smartphone, their Droid, and take pictures of different things in the business, take pictures of their house. Because a lot of people, when they have a claim, they don't realize what they have.
Right.
I moved about 2 years ago to my house, and I realized, wait a minute, I've got two sets of golf clubs. I forgot I had those.
Well, and it's different. Just like in your house, you need to do that for your business. You need to keep it current. You need to have the records stored off-site. You need your backup somewhere for your computers, your software, the systems, and those kind of things. But we really don't think about how much we're not aware of on a daily basis. Our business goes down, we're flooded, a hurricane hits, a tornado wipes us out. Whatever it is, we have that off-site, but we're down for a few weeks, a few months, a year, depending on, you know, if you're a manufacturing facility. In that time, where is the revenue coming from? Business interruption insurance? Revenue replacement?
Yeah, business interruption coverage right there will cover all that. One of the things you want to take a look at with the plan is what is the blackout period? A lot of them have maybe 3, 5, 7 days, or it could be 60 days they offer in the plan. A lot of times you can buy back those days.
Meaning blackout, meaning you can't make a claim?
I mean, it's like a deductible. The first 5 days, you can't make a deductible on that. Some plans actually start from day one, and that's one of the things you really want to look at, especially if you're a restaurant, you've got something where you've got a lot of overhead. You want to keep those good employees that you've got coming in and make the payroll. You also make sure that you have actual loss sustained, which is very important. Typical policy pays a certain amount each month. Actual loss sustained is whatever your actual losses are, you get back.
And how do you document that based on your historic records, your accounting?
Well, yeah, they're going to ask to see what it is, projected what it's going to be, and that goes into the rating factor. Also, another thing to think about, too, especially if you're a restaurant or something, a seasonal business, do you have peak season coverage on that, too, as well? Because let's say you're down at the beach in Wilmington, and you make all your money in 4 months of the year. You could make $1 million, $2 million, but in December, you're closed up. Well, if everything is annualized over a 12-month period, you only get a percent, you know, you get one-twelfth of it, that's not really going to help you out as much.
Yeah, when you need 90% of it for 4 months.
Exactly. Right. So you want to make sure you also have the peak season coverage. Another thing people don't think about is mechanical and electrical breakdown. What happens if you have that and all your equipment's knocked out?
Right.
Well, great if you have the income coming in, but now I got to fix the equipment because there's nothing, nothing's missing. It has had electrical surge or food spoilage. That's another thing people don't think about, too, is that's going to affect their business. You've got a restaurant. You may have $10,000 worth of fresh produce or especially meat. A lot of times they have a lot of meat in there, these big, large freezers. Mm-hmm. What happens if your power's out for more than 2 or 3 hours? You're going to have to throw everything out.
Right.
That's another thing to think about, too, with the business. And have a plan. You know, talk to your agent. What are you going to do? Or your broker, in case there is an issue. Do you have a backup? You know, how long is it going to take to get the equipment going, coming back in there and help you out?
Well, and when we're having this conversation with our broker, let's say we're a new restaurant starting up. We're starting from scratch. We don't have a customer base yet. So when we have that conversation, we're at one level. Mm-hmm. But let's say we open our doors and the grocery store next door has a fire or something shorts and our restaurant gets hit. How have we assessed replacement in that opportunity? Then we've just opened their doors. We're real popular. You know, people are in there every night. You know, we're packed. We have a waiting list. How do they assess how much that loss, actual loss, would be if they take that kind of coverage?
Well, that's a great question. One, they want to make sure they have actual loss sustained.
Okay.
Because then they show the receipts. They will, now, the beginning, they're going to rate based on what your projections are. If you just open a brand new restaurant, typically you're going to have a business plan you had to provide for
The banker,
that based on what your revenues are going to be. You've done some research because the bank's not going to lend you any money if you have no experience, you don't have any idea as far as what it's going to be, that you may, because they want to get their money back in case something does happen. So a lot of times they look at the business plan and kind of see what it is, but make sure you have the actual loss sustained, because let's say it went up. You got to maybe say $100,000, you only projected $50,000 because you're, you know, example of a restaurant, you're the new hit.
Right.
You make sure that you have that $100,000 coming in.
Well, and it's getting back to the point, we need to really understand our business and really sit down with a broker to walk through all those processes and ask those questions about where we're at. Do you have projections? What are these different riders that we need to consider? Mm-hmm. And have someone that can help you know what you don't know, to help you know what questions to ask and answer as you go through the process. Because we get the general liability, we get business interruption, we get the electrical riders, mm-hmm. the flood insurance, and we go through this. But what happens if we have dishonest employees for embezzlement and those kind of things, or somebody does spat, one of our employees loses it on the floor and throws food at a customer, those kind of things?
Well, throws food at a customer, something that's going to be more
assault.
Assault, yeah. One of the big important things that a lot of small businesses don't think about, especially accountants, attorneys, financial planners, is data breach. What happens if one of your employees decides, and it happens all the time with restaurants, they take all those credit card numbers and they hold
them. Just hit me a month ago at a restaurant.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. And they hold those credit card numbers and they sell it. Well, a lot of times they sell 6 months later, statistics show, so they don't know where it came from. So it's very hard to trace. They'll hold on to that. Or let's say they take your business list or Social Security numbers, dates of birth. Do you have that data breach? Because you have something like that happens, you have to qualify and file in each one of the states where your customer lives. So
Ouch.
You can imagine how much compliance that's going to be. And guess what? All 50 states have different rules.
I can't imagine that.
So you want to make sure that you have data breach coverage on that, make sure everything's taken care of. Also, employment practices liability. What happens if you give an example? Let's say that the manager is getting a little too friendly with one of the waitresses.
Okay. Hostile work environment.
Exactly. You could have sexual harassment. You could have, let's say, age discrimination. A lot of religious discrimination is coming through now. You may have seen where Walmart was recently in the news about as far as the Muslim women wearing the headscarves and also the Christians wearing the crosses. They don't want to have any display of religion. You could have something like that happen. Those are two new coverages that, 10, 12 years ago, we never heard about.
Well, and it's like as our businesses get more complex, as mm-hmm. our interaction on cloud technology, different applications, we have more mobile workforces with mm-hmm. more devices that take the information. There's a lot more things to think about. And again, mm-hmm. we, as business owners, we have to sit down and think about, where are our potential risks, and have a conversation about how well do we train our employees? How well do we screen our employees? What are the repercussions if someone takes a credit card number and mm-hmm. someone can make the connection? In my case, I just had the credit card for a few days with a new number. So actually, I guess a couple months. But I knew the card hadn't been out of my hand at any point except at the restaurant. But the interesting reaction was in calling the restaurant, the manager wouldn't take the call. So that kind of tells you also that they probably know that there's an issue and they've had an issue before. But that's not the best way to handle it. So we're looking at these types of things. We're trying to get our business protected. How we determine the limits. Let's think of another business. Let's say we're a courier service mm-hmm. or a flower shop and we have drivers out there driving. We've got the general, we've got the umbrella, but we have vehicles. We have all these other things. What do we need to think about for those types of businesses? What other coverages should we be thinking about?
Okay. That's very important. Typically, flower shop has somebody else, a local part-time girl is doing deliveries. You want to make sure that you have hired a non-owned auto, basically on any policy that you have for general liability. That basically is going to extend your limits for liability, or it could be on the commercial auto as well. For anything that's hired and non-owned, that covers Susie the secretary that goes to the bank run. That's one of the biggest things we see. You find out the business owner gets a letter saying, hey, you've been included in this suit because Susie, on the way to the bank, hit somebody. And we found out that she's got that bank bag sitting right there on the passenger side seat. And
right.
guess what? It's not only her personal vehicle. She's in the pursuit of her duties. And now we can bring the employer in.
Because she's acting as an agent of the company at the time
exactly.
of the accident.
And, of course, the attorneys, I've never seen them pass up more money they can get for their client, because typically they get a percentage of whatever the payout is.
Right, and that's again, it gets back to due diligence. So when mm-hmm. we have that kind of coverage, though, again, as business owners, to make sure the policy stays in force, there are certain things we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
We have to screen the employees. We have to make sure they have a good driving record. We have to do all of those kind of things and make sure that there are policies and procedures in place that make sure, again, we've trained the employee and those kind of things.
Exactly. A lot of businesses don't do that. They just hire somebody. They need to have somebody to get in the bind. Courier services, a lot of times they'll have drug testing. They'll have a lot of other things. They may have a CDL as well. They have a commercial fleet.
CDL, commercial driver's license.
Commercial driver's license. Of course, with the larger fleets like that, a lot of times they have telematics where they can basically see where they are anytime during the day. There's GPS enabled. And that's something to tell your insurance broker about, because guess what? A lot of times telematics provide additional discounts because they know how they're driving and everything's reported back to the company.
Right.
Like, well, a UPS or something like that.
Well, and if we have company-owned vehicles and we designate those for our employees, they can take them home because they're driving back and forth and those kind of things. Let's say it's a food truck.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like a big industry right now with everybody doing their food trucks. So we're out there. They're on the road. I own the truck. They've got the commercial license. But we have food issues. We have all kinds of other things out there. What do we think about in that kind of instance? And I didn't tell him I was going to ask him the food truck question.
Well, no,
so let's
see
how fast
we
see
a lot of that. First of all, you'll make sure that driver's listed on any commercial auto policy. That's one of the biggest things we see people forget about is they let one employee go or leave, and they hire a new one, and they never tell the insurance company.
So they need to notify the insurance company, the name, all
the
of
name,
those kind of things.
The date of birth, the driver's license. If you have a good broker, a lot of times you can call them and say, hey, would you pull this motor vehicle record? It's somebody we want to have. Seems great. I've done a couple of those where I call them in and look at them like, yeah, he's got 3 DUIs and child support somebody wants for him.
Right.
It may not be somebody you want to hire.
Well,
we can't release all the details, but we can say, you know, hey, this is not the best person for you.
So, but what? I like the food truck example because mm-hmm. I saw the story on the news not long ago, where the company had the food truck. He had multiple food trucks,
mm-hmm.
and he started noticing he wasn't making as much money, but his costs were going up.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out the employees were essentially taking the food truck in the evening, using his equipment, his food, draping a banner over the side to change the name, and then working for it from that truck, right? So what kind of coverage, what kind of things can an owner do to protect themselves when those kind of things happen? Essentially, it's a different form of embezzlement. They were eating them out of house and home by running a business there.
Not insurance, but you really want to make sure that you've really vetted your employees out. Look at it. If you have telematics, you know where they are. You can install that into the car.
You can't follow that under employee. I don't know. It's a new employee fraud. You know, we get coverages for things, but
typically
again,
employee fraud is limited to about $25,000 for both policies, and that's probably not going to be enough. What he's probably losing on,
but it would technically fall under that for at least part of it or some activity.
Depends on the company. I would check with the broker and what the actual wordage is or verbiage inside of the policy. That's something that claims is going to have to get down and research and figure out. I can't really.
Well, yeah, that's okay because I had never thought about it because it mm-hmm. just seemed so strange that, you know, he had an investigator mm-hmm. come in and they determined that had happened and mm-hmm. there were repercussions for it. But like you said, it ended up being a $50,000 or more loss for him mm-hmm. because of the use of the equipment, the number of days he lost the revenue, mm-hmm. the cost that went out, and those kind of things. But again, as business owners, we have to think about, as we go into new markets,
mm-hmm.
new ways of doing business, new things, and again, state to state it varies, but we really need to have in-depth conversations with our brokers.
Mm-hmm. And let them know if something's changed, because your policy requires you to notify them any changes.
And what constitutes a change? When we just said change of driver or something in that situation.
Change of driver, we've seen sometimes where they have moved, they've moved their location. You decided to offer more products that you didn't have previously listed on your policy. That's a big thing. Well, let's say you're a contractor and you're just doing framing. Well, hey, I got a new job with John Smith, and I can do some mold remediation, make some extra money, make twice as much money. Well, they find out, and there's a claim. Guess what? It's me red stamp with that nice big red stamp that says that you have no coverage. So you really want to, especially contractors, you can broaden what is it you're doing. And sometimes there's gray areas, but you always want to make sure ahead of time what is covered, what is not. You don't want to have – it's better to tell beginning and say, well, you can't do this under your policy, than go back and say, hey, will you cover a claim, please, please, please?
Right.
And then the adjuster says no.
Asking for forgiveness with insurance companies is not a good strategy for getting a claim covered.
No,
you
need
coverage.
Black and white.
Yes. Talking with Sean Adams of SJ Adams Insurance about business insurance coverages. And I kind of want to continue the conversation by taking an example. And let's think about businesses, because you were talking about the Jimmy Dean plant and it coming back on them for their subcontractors not having the right coverages and things. What do we do as a business if we hire contractors or subcontractors? What do we need to do in that process?
Okay. One of the first things I recommend you do is get a certificate of insurance. This basically is basically one sheet or two sheets that describes what coverages they have, and the agent signs off on that. I always tell my customers, go directly to the other the client's agent or brokerage and get it directly from them, get them to sign off. That's a big warning sign. If they won't sign it, it means they're behind on their payments or the policy could have lapsed. And that gives you a pay-by-play. A lot of people say, oh, yeah, I have coverage. Well, they may have had it, you know, for 2 months and let it lapse, and then they'll go around next year a lot of times to get a new policy. A lot of the big, like Beazer and several big companies started seeing with some of their subs where they start requiring it quarterly. So certificate of insurance, one thing to look for is to make sure the name matches the company.
The legal name has to be there. It has to be the legal name that you're contracting with.
Exactly. That's also any kind of business insurance. Make sure that your name, if you change to LLC, INC, or something else, update your policy because it could be a coverage issue as well.
And one of the ways you can check that is to go to the Secretary of State's office, mm-hmm. registration under corporations in most states, and look to see if they're registered as a business, how they're registered. Are they a foreign business, a domestic? And you can get that on your own. Start there to know what the legal names are of companies and contractors.
That's great. A lot of times, those contractors are not listed there because they're doing business as. They could be Jim Bob's Paint Service.
Right.
So they may not be required to register. All the corporations are going to be registered there. General liability, look at that. You want to make sure they have at least limits of $1 million per occurrence, $2 million aggregate on that certificate. Did they go with the cheapest thing they could find, or they have $100,000? If they're doing work on your business and you've got a $500,000 building, you don't want to have $100,000 in coverage in case, let's say they're an electrician and they mess up with the wiring and the whole building goes.
I had a client, the plumber didn't do the plumbing correctly. They were down 6 weeks because the pipe burst, flooded everything, and now the insurance company's going back against the plumber. But in the meantime, if he didn't have coverage, that was going to be an issue.
Exactly. Another big thing a lot of customers don't think about is make sure they have workers' comp. Because even if it's your home they're doing work on, in North Carolina, you're considered a contractor as far as legal term. Even though you don't have your GC license, you can know nothing about contracting. They can apply against your homeowner's policy for getting hurt. It doesn't matter if they're a corporation, if they're individual or anything else. There's what's called the North Carolina Industrial Commission. It's very lax on what they define as far as an employee.
Right, because I know we were trying to get our deck done, and mm-hmm. One of the neighbors was using somebody, he goes, oh, he's really great. And I'm like, is he a contractor? Does he have insurance? And they're like, well, no. And I'm like, nobody's working on my house that high up without those kind of things.
Exactly. And that's one of the things, too. If they can't get insurance, there's probably a good reason for that. They may do great work, but you make sure they're going to be there, one, to finish the job.
Right.
Or are they going to do it to code? Are they bonded? Are they going to go inside your property? What happens if one of their employees decides to take something souvenirs home? It could be your iPod. It could be something else there. What happens if that disappears?
Your jewelry
at your house,
right, yeah.
Business, take something there. Companies are not going to be bonded unless they have a certain credit rating because they're going to look at that. Also, if you're going to have a large job, you may want to have what's called a bid bond, where basically the insurance company guarantees the work's going to be done, and if the work is not completed, the insurance company hires another contractor to come back in and finish the job. Really, what we see a lot of times with tree companies, people call, hey, if they have a large claim, we got, Jim Bob example again, he takes his truck, cut everything down. What happens if he doesn't secure that tree right and the wind changes and that falls on your house or your building?
Kind of like the insurance commercial where the guy's cutting the branch off and it lands on the car.
Exactly.
Right.
All kinds of things like that could happen. So make sure they also have products and complete operations in the GL. If they leave the site, something goes wrong. In North Carolina, they can go up, I think it's either 5 or 6 years on a homeowner's. I don't know what it is for business. But that's something the contractor's on hold. And if you have that certificate, that really helps you out. Also, if you get audited for your own workers' comp for your business, and they say, okay, well, you paid so-and-so this amount of money, you get that certificate, they wipe out that amount that you paid for them. So it also gives you credit on your policy. Because in North Carolina, if you are a GC and you don't have certificates for subs, they're going to add that back on to your workers' comp. And guess what? You got to pay the percentage, whatever the premium is, for that.
Out.
Yeah, it could be $100,000.
Well, again, it's doing our homework and make sure we mm-hmm. have the right records, we're taking the right steps and doing that. And our broker guides us through that process. Because mm-hmm. when we're working with someone like yourself, you know what that file needs to have and mm-hmm. what the steps we need to make sure that we've spent the money. We need to stay covered spending the money.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you also do is you can have that certificate faxed directly to your broker and call them and say, hey, do they have everything they need to have? They can keep a copy on your file, make sure everything's there in case something does happen. Also, another thing they can do, a lot of times they'll be added, especially if you're a landlord or something else, you want to be added as additional insured onto that policy. So if anything happens to one of your tenants, let's say you've got the restaurant and somebody trips and falls outside, or it could be a bar. Let's say they've got a little domestic little thing at 3 o'clock in the morning. Of course, you know, bars, they change after 12 o'clock. There's a different crowd that comes in. And what happens
if somebody gets hurt? No, I've never been in a bar after midnight. Really.
The landlord can get pulled into the lawsuit. Right. But if they have additional insured rider on the tenant, before the plaintiff can sue the landlord, they have to go after the tenant's policy first.
Okay.
And that's another thing also that really helps out a lot.
Well, I know frequently we drive on roads in shopping centers and things. Mm-hmm. I remember this happened with my brother many years ago. But you're driving down a road you think is a public road because everybody uses it, and you find it's actually private property and someone runs a stop sign or something and creams you in the parking, essentially, but turns out to be a parking lot. Is there coverage that we need to think of about that too when we have parking facilities or a parking garage, all of those kind of things that we need to be aware of, the additional coverages? How do we protect for those kind of things?
Okay. Well, two parts to that. One, anytime you're involved in an auto accident, unless the police officer tells you to move the car, stay where you are, take pictures, because that police report, especially if you're not at fault, is your get-out-of-jail-free card.
Okay.
It's going to show, and the other party is responsible for the damages. The insurance company can't take your word. They're going to have, let's say there's two different
right.
things, or and it's funny, I was actually involved in an auto accident in a parking lot when I was 17, and my father told me to stay there. Lady was so sorry that she hit me, did more damage to her car. I was in a Ford Bronco, so it only bent the, had to replace the bumper.
Right.
But 2 weeks later, she wasn't returning my calls to pay that amount
right.
out to me. And so I had to file against her insurance. If I didn't have that police report, they would say, well, she says that she's not at fault now. Her story changed.
Well, and the other thing is to make sure when that mm-hmm. officer is writing things down that it's not – that it's accurate at the time, because mm-hmm. it's very hard for even for police officers who are trained to necessarily make sure they get the sequence incorrectly. I know my mom got hit in the parking lot, and they said she hit the other guy, but the tire marks were across the front of her car. And I was like, physics says when there are imprints on the front of her car – I mean, literally, it was – and it bent down the entire front of her car, you could not have hit. Her car would have been smashed. So laws of physics. So when you're getting police reports, you even have to make sure that that matches to the evidence of what's happened in
the
accident.
You want to get any witnesses that have seen it, because you as a party, the police officer, is going to be hearing two different stories.
Right.
So if there's a third-party witness, also that's very important, you do not move the car.
Right.
You move the car, the police officer cannot determine who is at fault. And guess what? Each party is responsible for their own damage, which happens a lot. Now, let's give going back to the second part of your question, what happened about parking facilities, somebody gets hurt? You want to make sure that you have liability, general liability on top of that. A lot of times parking garages have additional what's called an umbrella policy that goes over in case there's a catastrophic loss. What happens if somebody is hit and run and killed?
Right.
Or let's say the parking attendant is killed. Could be an armed guard walking around. Do they have coverage for that? Do they have endorsements on their policies? And that's something you really want to sit down and share a lot. Sometimes clients come to me at first and they say, okay, well, they want to share me as little information as possible because they're afraid to say, I don't want to spend extra money.
Right.
You want to make sure that you are taking care of the risk first, because insurance, we're getting it back to where you were before. And some things you don't want to cut back on the cost, because then you are what's called self-insuring, where you are personally insuring against. And that can hurt you out a lot.
Well, and if you haven't maintained adequate separation between your business, especially a sole proprietor or someone mm-hmm. that's not incorporated or an LLC, that liability comes back to you personally, because that's mm-hmm. just reaching through your business into your personal assets, and everything starts being up as self-insured. Everything's fair game.
Well, yeah, they call it what's called piercing the corporate veil. And that's one of the things, too, I see a lot of times where, let's say they set up an LLC, it's typically in a rental house. But in order to get financing with the local credit union, they're going to put in their personal name.
Right.
Or they'll have the liability in order to save $50 or $100, take off their homeowner's policy and go over the rental house.
Right.
Well, if the liability is in your personal name and somebody gets hurt, what's the attorney going to do?
Sue the person.
Exactly. They just basically have pierced it. So in order to save $50, you open up all of your assets to be in suit.
Well, and it's I don't know if I'm fortunate or unfortunate. When I see things, I tend to think of what's this risk, what's this implication. And another news story I saw this weekend being 4th of July was that policies get invalidated by behaviors. In states where it's illegal to have fireworks, you're out there setting off fireworks, and you set somebody's house on fire, it's illegal to be doing fireworks. You're no longer covered on your policy because it was an illegal act. You can set your house on fire. You can do all these kind of things. So when you start thinking through things, you just think, oh, there's no harm to it. There is harm to it, especially if someone is at a business setting off those fireworks. It may be your business, but there's a lot of implications to that. And suddenly you've done a behavior that invalidates all this investment you've made in protecting your business.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, business, a lot of times they're setting off fireworks. They have a third party that's setting out for them because they want to have a nice big display. For instance,
yeah, not in this instance.
Well, always check with your broker before you do a plan. What are you planning on doing? Another thing that also happens a lot of times is you're going to have, let's say, an after-hours event, and you're going to charge, let's say, $2 for beer because you're going to keep the cost. People don't think about there's what's called liquor liability as part of your general liability.
That was going to be my very next question.
As long as you're not charging for the alcohol. When you charge under North Carolina law, you're becoming under the ABC standard. And guess what? You just invalidated anything that happens. So what happens if
ABC meaning Alcoholic Beverage Commission.
Exactly. Alcoholic Beverage Commission, and you're required to hold a license. You're required to meet all kinds of criteria in order, what's called the AWARE program, where you're making sure somebody's, you know, 16-year-old is not getting, or 17-year-old getting alcohol under the age of 21.
Well, and that someone doesn't leave the facility driving drunk. Those kind of things, too. Because I have this a lot of times with my nonprofit clients when they're going to do a fundraiser that as a wine tasting or something of that event. But to really make sure they understand, because they're taking a donation at the door, say $50, $100, or whatever, does that kick us into the ABC rules? Does it not? And making sure, again, like you were saying, that people who are not supposed to be getting alcohol are not getting alcohol, and those leaving are not imbibing to the point that they're dangerous when they leave the facility and drive.
Exactly. You want to make sure there's no way that you are charging for that alcohol. So if you're going to charge, let's say you're having a fundraiser and you charge $25 a plate.
Right.
You want to have whoever the vendor is that's providing the alcohol for you, providing the food, get a certificate from them. Let them handle all of the alcohol, everything there, and you don't handle any of it. Or you can have what's
but
like
then
cash
it gets
bar.
That back to the contractor, making sure you do your homework with the contractor. And
exactly.
Coverages.
Do you have a certificate of insurance? Or you can have like a cash bar where, let's say, the restaurant is assuming all of that. What you don't want to have is the members of your nonprofit collecting money for the drinks.
Well, and do you need to have that conversation with the restaurant or the venue if they're going to be providing the alcohol and handling it? What coverages do they have, those kind of things, to ensure that they have the right things in place?
That's why you want to get a certificate of insurance and talk to your broker. That really piece of paper helps out a lot. It basically shows what coverages they have and limits your liability for the risk. Cities and states have gotten very familiar with that. A lot of times if you're going to, like you mentioned, the food truck thing, they require a certificate from each one of those vendors, and they'll name the city as additional insured.
Okay.
And that's very typical where something happens. They have to go after the food truck first before they come after the city.
Well, and it's sort of let's take the food truck example and then take it sort of in a little bit different direction because I remembered my question that I said at the break I had forgotten.
Okay.
Product liability.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm working with new companies and some established companies and say they're creating new recipes and food in particular where there are allergies and things that can happen and exposures to, you know, food poisoning and those kind of things. What does a business need to think about when it comes to product liability or service liability? And how do we walk through that process to know how much coverage we need, what information we have to share? And as you were saying, adding new services or new products and those kind of things.
Okay. Let me backtrack just real quick. Product liability is typically with like a toy that's manufactured incorrectly. What you're thinking of is more the food and beverage with somebody.
Okay.
Get sick over the food. So let me just clarify that. So this is not product liability, which is something like Mako recalls a bunch of toys or Toys R Us recalls something.
So what does it fall under if, let's say, I manufacture a prepackaged food? Is that product liability? Where does it fall?
More, It can be. That's kind of a gray area. What we're looking more, if a restaurant, if somebody gets sick, that's going to be the products and complete operations when they leave the site. That's why you want to have, you know, at least $2 million in coverage on that. Because you have a huge thing. What happens if, you know, somebody, it could be a bad lettuce. A lot of that goes in the preparation. Also make sure your employees are trained well. Do you have the separation for the meat part versus the vegetables? Usually they require a lot of times either a metal wall or some kind of separation, either several feet apart from each other, because E. coli, a lot of the different bacteria can easily transfer from the meat over into the vegetables. And, of course, when you cook it, you've killed all the E. coli, but the vegetables will still carry it.
Right. So I have an example, or a question. I worked for a business when I moved here to North Carolina, and they decided to do their own cookout, company cookout. And so the executives were out there cooking on the nice big grills, which is a typical Southern thing. Never did it in the North. But what I watched was them taking raw chicken, putting it on the grill, taking cooked steaks off, and serving them. That's a liability issue. That's a bad food practice. That's everything else. But companies don't tend to think about those kind of company events when they're doing things and maintaining good food practices. What's the liability risk there?
Somebody get hurt and basically sue the company or get sick. We see that, not only that, but also, let's say, chicken salad. We have a lot of hot weather, or tuna salad, that mayonnaise is one of the first things to spoil. That's something you can have with your executives. You start out with, you can have one side of the grill typically is the raw, and the other side is the completed product. So that's one of the basic things you kind of have with the executives, and that helps them out. You know, you don't use the same utensils. But if something does happen, you make sure that company event is taken care of. A lot of times those are handled off-site. If it's at somebody's house, all of a sudden the homeowner's liability could come into force, and make sure that you do have that umbrella policy, so if somebody does get sick, there could be an issue there as well.
What about having something catered on-site? What kind of issues come up with those types of things?
Okay. That's a great example. You catered, again, you get the certificate of insurance from the catering company.
Okay.
They've got coverage for that. And they're liable for anything that goes wrong. So let's say that something is not prepared well enough, the chicken's not cooked. You mentioned burgers. I see a lot of times at restaurants where they will bring the burger out, and it's real popular right now to have medium rare.
It's mooing.
It's mooing. You know, it's pink. It's got lots of juice in it. It supposedly tastes great, but you haven't really killed off any of the bacteria that could be inside.
Right, but I mean, there are some restaurants that are set up because of the quality of their meat, they meet that special standard for being able to provide it. But you see that warning at the bottom of most restaurant menus saying undercooked foods, products, that stuff is, you know, potentially a health hazard. You can make that choices. Then other restaurants just say, we don't serve anything less than well-done burgers.
And they're still liable either way.
Right.
Like, for instance, you go to somebody's that's what people don't think about, too. You've got a no trespassing sign on your business. You lock up the gates. Somebody breaks in and gets hurt. They can still sue you. They should go to jail. They can still sue you. I love a case. There was one recently read about a magazine in Pennsylvania where this guy broke into a house and got into the garage as the family was leaving to go to Disney World for vacation. Couldn't get out of the garage. Had a nice big metal door. He ate Alpo, a dog food, and Pepsis for a week and a half. Can you imagine how
what a diet.
Yeah, and that garage must have had a nice smell to it during the summer months, but he still got pain and suffering, went to jail, but still got pain and suffering paid to him for mental anguish because he was locked in. He was without his will.
He couldn't go back out the way he got in, apparently.
No, evidently he went in the garage as they were leaving.
Okay, he slid under the door.
Slid under the door and thought he'd get in there, but there was a door separating that from the house.
But that kind of thing is part of what our system in the course of committing a crime, a felony, or whatever, that you can be able to sue, that it's a product of your own decision to go somewhere you weren't supposed to be, doing something you were supposed to do, but yet the homeowner or the business can be on the hook for
exactly. Which is, doesn't seem fair, but that's how it works with the law.
So things that are in the news, let's cover some of the ones that are really bad situations, but we see this with small mom-and-pop grocery stores, gas stations. They get robbed and your employee gets killed or severely injured by the robber. How do we improve our protection for employees? How do we protect them, and what coverage do we need?
Okay. One, you want to make sure that you have wrongful death endorsement on your policy. Some especially gas stations, look, oh, okay, well, I can save, you know, $500 or $1,000 here by taking that exclusion. Well, that's a lot of liability. Also, you've got to be open late hours. The later hours attract some of the nuisances that come out.
That's a polite way to call it.
Exactly. Or you can have, for instance, I went to a gas station recently, and they have a little pull-down glass that comes down. That's a deterrent.
Right.
You don't keep a certain amount of money. 7-Eleven pioneered it where they have these safes in the ground. They can only deposit in, and they can't withdraw any money except during, you know, normal business hours when the manager's there from like 9 to 5. So that's some of the things you can do basically to help. Also, be attentive.
Well-lit. All those kind of
things. Your employees, are they attentive? Are they looking at who's coming into the store? Are they casing it out? That's one thing you can definitely look at. You know, say hi to them. If you look them straight in the eyes, you're going to have less likely for somebody to want to rob you because you're making that eye contact. You know, just basically, you have cameras. You know, keep it on the feed. Don't have it where it's every, you know, 30 minutes and deletes the video. That's
right.
Not going to help you.
No.
With going to find somebody.
Well, and storage is such an inexpensive thing to now just have it for 30 minutes doesn't really do anything for you.
Exactly. You know, basically take the procedures, train your employees to start to look for stuff. Because if they're sitting there reading a magazine when somebody walks in and say, hey,
yeah,
guess what? You're an easy target. But if you're looking them in the eyes, you see something's wrong, you have a panic button or something else that you can push, there's something you can do that's a safe area for the employees. There are certain steps that you can make, and that's something you talk with your agent or broker about. Do you have a glass enclosed space that's safe for them for that after hours employee that's staying
right.
in there? If they know they're not going to get any money, they're not going to go after it.
So we're heading towards the end of the hour. We have like mm-hmm. 2 minutes left to talk. Let's go back to true product liability. Let's say I'm manufacturing a ladder. And it's a folding ladder and all these kind of things. What kind of insurance coverages do I need for that, and how do I go about assessing that?
The manufacturer's liability is going to be a little bit different. Now, we don't do with a lot of that because we're not a manufacturing here. I can answer kind of briefly.
That's fine.
You want to have product liability. A lot of times that's done through an excess and surplus lines carriers, a separate policy they have. Typically, a lot of big businesses will self-insure for the first million or $2 million, and then they'll have a policy on top of that. It covers that.
So I'm going to throw like these really quick things out. Feel free to
keep you on my toes today, aren't you?
Yeah. I didn't warn Sean that this could go this way. So let's say I'm a daycare center.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of things do I need to think about?
Okay. Well, daycares have, you have a lot of kids.
Right.
Big thing is, who are your employees? No matter how nice they are, do a very good background check. How are they disciplining the kids? That's one of the biggest things you have right now is, you know, little Tommy won't do what you're supposed to do, and they spank him. Well, the parents may
sounds
not
good
like
to
that.
Me. No, I'm just kidding.
Do they have the sexual molestation coverage they're required by the state? And that's one of the big things, too. And a lot of times that could be, for instance, it's paid out under the table. They mm-hmm. make a negotiation or something. If there is a claim, or it could not be a claim, it could be somebody, you know, crying wolf. But if that gets out in the public, your business is gone.
Well, that leads to a great question then, mm-hmm. reputation insurance. Is there such a thing, and if so, what does it do? So, I know it's called something else. So it's defamation and those
things. You can have defamation or personal injury. You can have, I don't know of anything as far as reputation insurance.
Okay.
You make sure that you have the sexual molestation coverage. Do you have actually had a class example of this. We had one that was a daycare here in the Triangle. One of the kids came back with meningitis. And, of course, all the parents
panic
and pulled all their kids out of that business. They could have, you know, loss of income for that. You know, what if they have to have all the testing? I mean, there's a lot of things people don't think about that you have your procedures in force. And just basically, the big thing is your employees trained to look for, you know, saying, okay, this kid looks sick, there's something not right, call the parent immediately, get something beginning. Don't just, put them for nap time.
Well, I'm going to thank Sean for being on the show today, and we're wrapping up. Sean, give them your website
okay,
so that
sure.
they know how to reach you.
Our website is sjadamsinsurance.com, and we have resources available on there if you have any questions about business insurance and other lines of business. You can also contact us online through Facebook.
Give them your Facebook.
It's facebook.com/s.j.adams insurance. We also have Google Plus. There's different ways you can contact us. And if you have any questions, feel free to give me a call or shoot us an email. We'll be happy to answer any questions you have about any insurance there.
So what's your phone number?
Phone number is 919-571-2598. And we have available and also have a staff there, so if I'm not immediately available, somebody else there in our office can also answer your questions.
Well, thank you for being on the show today.